This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Bridge staff writer Nancy Derringer tells us about the initial promising results of an effort to improve reading in some West Michigan school districts, including those in Allegan and Barry counties. But first, construction on a key section of the Dakota Access Pipeline has been halted for now. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers denied a permit that would have allowed for construction just north of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. The proposed path of the pipeline brought protesters to North Dakota from around the country. We're going to talk to one woman who made the journey from Kalamazoo. Monica Washington Padula was part of the protest at Standing Rock in November. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Bonjour.
What made you decide that you wanted to go and be part of this protest?
Well, I think, like many of us, I was in a big state of disbelief viewing the videos on social media of the attacks on the water protectors, and really felt helpless. Like, there was nothing I could do. Yeah, we could send money. We could send messages of encouragement and support to those there. But it was one of those just deep-seated convictions that made me really wonder, well, is there more that I could do? And I really felt that it was something that I could put forth more effort towards, especially being an Indigenous woman. I definitely felt that responsibility to take up action when I heard the call for help.
Did you have any concerns yourself about personal safety when you went there?
Absolutely. For me personally, I purposefully took a couple of months to gauge the situation. Is it going to get better? Someone's going to step in. Somebody from the administration is going to step in. This isn't going to get far. Somebody's going to make sure that these protectors see justice from what they're experiencing and what we're watching them experience. But I had to face the reality that it really was not getting better. And so by the time I had my trip planned, which I planned it a month in advance, I was along the way hoping that things would get better and that I wouldn't have to take that trip. But once I saw that they were not and it was getting worse, then I knew that it really wasn't an option. The biggest fears was that in my communications with people who had both been there, who were currently keeping an eye on the situation, and basically what was floating around the media, I was mostly concerned about being stopped by the police. There were stories of people being stopped and having their items confiscated, having them desecrated, and that there was an overall attempt to prevent people from being able to take needed supplies to the camp, and our caravan was taking some supplies for donation. So that was my biggest concern, was facing that before I even made it into the camp. Luckily, we did go an alternate route where we were able to evade that, and we were able to get there safely with no problems. And so I think that we were pretty fortunate in that.
And let's remind people, when exactly did you go? What dates are we talking about?
I arrived on the 23rd, and I stayed until that, which was a Tuesday, and I stayed through Thanksgiving until that Saturday evening, which I believe was the 26th.
So can you give us a synopsis of what you saw over those several days when you were in North Dakota?
Absolutely. Because of the nature of the trip, I really did not know what to expect. And I think that that was true for a lot of people, especially like my travel partners who were going with me. We really didn't know what to expect. We were keeping up with what was going on social media and just trying to be as prepared as possible. But that was a little difficult just because things could change from day to day. So reports of what protectors had experienced the night before could have changed. And so we were just really, I think, trying to put ourselves in a space where we would be prepared for whatever. And overall, just getting there in and of itself was a big act of accomplishment for us. Once we got there and we pulled up alongside the side of the camp to get to the entrance, I remember seeing all of the signs, and the signs were kind of what made it real for me. Like, these people, they've been camped out here, they've made signs, and just reading through those, it really made it real. It's like, this is where it's happening, this is where this movement is happening, and this resistance is happening, and I'm privileged to be able to be here and to be able to join in solidarity with my Indigenous relatives and also those who have come who are non-Native to support. Again, that whole not knowing what to expect once I was inside of the camp, you know, was kind of quickly settled after maybe a day or so there. However, again, anything could change at any moment. And so just always having that apprehension in the back of your mind that this could not be like this tomorrow or later tonight. And just, I was prepared to go with the flow. Whatever needed to be done, wherever I was needed, was kind of what my goal was, what my agenda was. And for me, it was even deeper than going to stand up against the injustice of this one isolated incident of this pipeline being put within 10 minutes of the reservation. It was also a way for me to be able to be in a space that was Indigenous-led and that was populated with so many tribal nations coming together in a way that hasn't been done since the 70s. And to be able to be in that space and be around a community and culture that I frankly did not have the privilege of growing up with and growing up around, it was even more of a type of a spiritual need for me. And so to be able to combine the need that the tribe had with almost a need that I also had to be immersed in that type of space, it served that for me. One thing that I want to share is that when we first arrived, everyone was asked to attend an orientation to get an idea of what the camp was like and what the goal and mission was. And the two main ideas that I walked away with that really stuck with me was, first of all, the camp was not a festival. It was not a party, it was not a reunion, it was not a celebratory type of atmosphere.
Very serious?
It was more, it's sacred. Mm. So it was a place where we were coming to be in prayer and ceremony, and to take away kind of the fun aspect that people might have, like kind of the novelty aspect, we're going to do something new, we're resisting, that kind of got put into check when we got there. And we were reminded, this is serious, this is not a joke. This is not a drill. Every single day that you're here, you're participating actively in resistance, and we need to remember that we have to stay in prayer. This needs to be a prayerful space. And I also just really, really appreciated that being said, and it helped to remind me to try to approach any of the activities that I was involved in that way, with that sense of sincere respect and honor.
You mentioned that idea of being with other Indigenous people. And I guess one thing I wonder is, does this issue maybe move across tribal lines in a way that is different than maybe past experiences that you've had?
Absolutely. There are a few articles out there that I've read that mentioned that this incident specifically united tribes in a way that they haven't been united in a long time, whether because of just past historical conflict within, you know, each nation. Again, going back to what I said before, is that many of us felt really convicted inherently. And I think that's tied to being who we are as Native people, is that when we see a group that's having an issue and having a problem and they need our help, we need to be there. And I think that was felt really, really strongly in the situation. And so it did bring together different tribes that formerly may not have been associated together or worked together in a really long time. And I think that that's an amazing form of healing for what our nations have been through here in America. And so I really found that to be one of the, I would say, the positive aspects of this very serious issue, is that on this hand, it brought us together and it caused us to have to stand together with one mission, one purpose, one intent, and on the same agenda. And I think that that was extremely powerful.
You are someone who's been involved in other issues specifically related to mascots, schools using Native
Absolutely.
American mascots for sporting events, for their sports teams. Do you see a connection between these two issues? And I guess if so, what would that connection be?
Absolutely. I need to share that as Indigenous people, based on the history of America and how it was founded and where the land came from, and even more specifically in this issue with DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, the fact that it is on unceded Sioux land is really important, because it kind of it brings to light this conflict over what's whose and who has the rights to what. And I think it's really important to always remember, first and foremost, that we owe a lot of what we have to the people that were here before and set it up for us. So with that being said, at the same time, historically, there were many things set into place that prevented Native and Indigenous people from having access to equal rights. And even now, we're still struggling for those, and Native mascots are one key way that we are not on the table with other, even minority status races, as far as our race, culture, and spirituality being used as a mascot and as a show, accompanied with all kinds of antics that are very, very disrespectful and taken out of context of what they mean to us for sporting and athletic events. So the reason that they're tied hand in hand is because just like this pipeline is being put in the ground next to a reservation and basically letting these people know that this water is we want to protect it for ourselves, but, you know, we're really not as concerned. If it's protected for you, you'll figure it out, you'll deal with it. And then the same thing transferring over to mascots. This is something that we want for ourselves. We want to take on this persona and this pseudo identity. And, you know, even though, yeah, it originally came from you, you kind of just need to deal with what we want to do with it. And you'll figure it out.
So the victory, such as it is at Standing Rock, may be temporary. There's going to be a new administration coming in. This can get reviewed again. Do you view this as something that you would be willing to go back and protest again to stand up for what you believe on this?
Absolutely. The very difficult thing is watching members of this tribe and their supporters basically be brutalized by the police. I think that was the hardest thing to witness and to watch. And if that type of violence is something that's going to continue and it's going to keep, you know, mounting and growing, I absolutely feel that we need to, again, step up our direct action and our physical presence there. Of course, we all hope for the best, but given our history with the United States and with broken promises, we have to stay on edge and we have to stay alert and looking out. Would I personally go back? I would. It would be difficult, you know, given our everyday life, but then remembering that this is a strong need and this is something that that is very meaningful to fight for. A lot of people like myself, we just have to make it work.
Monica Padula, Washington, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You can find links with more coverage of the protests at Standing Rock and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' decision to deny a permit for a key section of the Dakota Access Pipeline at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Bridge recently reported that an effort to boost the reading scores in some West Michigan school districts is showing early signs of success. The Reading Now Network includes Allegan and Barry counties, along with 11 others stretching north. Bridge staff writer Nancy Derringer's story is called In State with Low Reading Scores, a West Michigan effort shows promise. She joins us via Skype. Nancy Derringer, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with your headline. You say that in a state with low reading scores, how low are the reading scores in Michigan?
Pretty terrible. We are at 41st now, I believe, and we have been steadily sliding for the last decade or so. And according to the people who track this sort of data, we are headed for even lower in the next few years if we don't do something to turn things around.
And the state has decided to address this in part by passing a law that says if you don't reach a certain reading level by the third grade, you may not move on and go
yes.
to the next grade, correct?
Yes, exactly. It's the drop-dead threshold at third grade. And the thinking behind this is would be familiar to anybody who has even a glancing familiarity with public education. You know, in fourth grade, that is when they say students stop learning to read and start reading to learn. That's obviously they don't stop learning to read, but the focus goes from teaching the skills of reading itself to reading to actually convey information about various subject matters. And so it's critical that children be within, they don't necessarily have to be right at grade level. I think they're allowed to be one level behind by third grade, but if they're any farther behind than that, then they have to repeat. And that educators will tell you is kind of a nuclear option. They really, really don't like to retain children, at least not in the third grade. And so this effort is designed to minimize that number to the greatest extent possible.
But the people with the Reading Now Network also told you that they actually were moving on this before that law was even passed by the state legislature. So why exactly did they identify reading as something that they should focus on?
Well, it's as the saying goes, it's fundamental. Reading is fundamental. It's pretty much every subject area in school depends on reading as its absolute cornerstone. But you're incorrect where you say they did this even ahead of this law taking effect. I mean, the law's been signed. It's the clock is ticking. It's the children who are in kindergarten this year are the first ones who are going to be judged by the time they when they reach third grade. And so they want to start this as early as possible with children in those very early grades. And if they do need to be retained, and some children simply will have to be retained, it's much less damaging to a kid to do it early on than to wait until third grade. So if you have a kindergartner repeat, it's not that big a deal. I mean, we separate kindergartners into young fives and older fives, and we have, you know, there's many states have some sort of a 2-year kindergarten plan anyway. So having, you know, if it happens at that age, it's much less emotionally scarring to a child than to wait until they're a little bit older.
So Reading Now was not ahead of this, but the Reading Now people insist that this is not a direct response to the state law.
Right. I think they heard the discussion. I think, you know, they say, oh, no, this has nothing to do with this law. But I think that and they claim it's a coincidence. But, you know, this law didn't just pop up overnight. I think they knew what was coming down the road.
So exactly how does it work? What happens in this more intense reading atmosphere?
Okay, well, more time in each school day is devoted to reading. There is now a 90 to 120 minute block in every school in the morning, first thing in the morning, that is devoted simply to reading. And, you know, it's not a teacher at the front of the room. It's a whole constellation of activities, one-on-one, independent reading time, you know, skills, phonics, all that stuff. But you know, an hour and a half to 2 hours of every school day, first thing in the morning, has to be devoted to reading. And so this is based on basically kind of a best practices study that they did within their own within their own region. This is, you said it's 13 counties. It's more than I think it's about 100 public school districts. And this is consists of Region 3 in the State Department of Education. And so they looked at the schools that were overachieving, quote unquote overachieving, according to their poverty level, and said, well, how are they doing it? And so then this is what they came up with. Basically a singular focus on reading early in the morning in every class.
And it's important, I think, to note what you said there about overachieving according to their poverty level. In other words, not just simply looking at what the most wealthy school districts are doing, but districts where the reading scores would seem to be better than you would expect based on the level of poverty in the district, et cetera.
Yes, exactly. I mean, they basically did a scatter plot, which you've probably seen, that diagonal line that shows that, you know, the higher the income of the homes these kids come from, the better they tend to do in school. This is simply an undeniable fact in education. And then they looked for the outliers. Who is taking what they have, the student body that they have, and doing better than expected with it? And they identified, I believe, 5 different schools, and went in and just kind of analyzed how things were set up there, and are copying that throughout the district, or throughout the region, rather.
And you introduce us to Lakeshore Elementary in Holland as one of these outliers. What happens here that other districts may now be trying to copy?
Well, they have a principal who is simply very intensely focused, Jens Milibinsky, on reading. And he is the first one to admit that, you know, he kind of inherited this excellent school. It's out in it's kind of out in sort of what I would call a ruburban a landscape. There's a lot. It's kind of rural. It's kind of suburban, small farmettes and some agriculture out there. But it does attract a very diverse student body, not ethnically so much as economically. It was a blue ribbon school just a couple of years ago. They have about 50% school of choice enrollment. They have a large number of children who come from poverty, and quite a few of them are the children of migrant farm workers who are migratory. And so some of these kids have the added challenge of being taken out of school for months at a time as they follow their parents around where the work is, the farm work is, and then they come back. And, you know, if you know anything about education, this is something that can be very difficult for a kid to overcome. I mean, they children really thrive on consistency that way. But somehow they have figured out a way to make it work. And one of the things that Principal Milibinsky is a big believer in is parental involvement as volunteers. And if you look at my story, there's a photograph of him standing in front of a very large bulletin board with just what looks like a couple of hundred lanyards hanging on it. Anybody who comes into the school generally has to check in with the office and wear a lanyard that identifies who they are. And these are worn by the parent volunteers who come in and during that reading block and do one-on-one reading with individual children just to give the parent or to give the teacher just some extra help.
Now, if someone looks at the map of this Reading Now network where it's in place, again, 13 counties, as you said, over 100 school districts in there. So some of those are not necessarily poor. A lot of them are probably pretty well-to-do. Are all the school districts participating here? And do the districts where, or maybe the individual schools where there is, higher incomes, are they getting something out of this as well?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the keys, I think, to this program, according to Kyle Mayer, who is sort of one of the guys overseeing it. Nobody gets off on this one. And one of the other schools that I visited was Woodridge Elementary, which is in Zeeland. And that's a much more affluent school. I wish I could tell you more about the neighborhood that it sits in, but the day that I visited, there was an absolute pea soup fog that had come into the area, and I could barely see my hand in front of my face. So I kind of came upon this thing following my GPS. But in any event, it is it's a higher income average school. Their test scores are above state average. But when they looked at that scatter plot, they said, you know, for this kind of student body, they could be doing a lot better. And so the day that I was there, they were doing an in-service with one of the principals from one of these initial five target schools that they studied, helping the principal there and some other staff who had come in think of, you know, new ways to use that 90 to 120 minute block. And so, you know, Kyle Mayer was very diplomatic about saying, you know, this required a lot of not just pressure, but also diplomacy. I mean, I had to walk into some of these schools and say, you know, you think you're doing okay, but I think you could be doing better. You know, are you willing to open your mind to some different strategies and see if we can't improve? And, you know, apparently he was able to get some people on board. And this is one of the schools where they did.
Now, you tell us that this is kind of modeled after something in healthcare called the heart attack protocol. Explain right. What that is for people who are not familiar with that term.
Okay. Well, the way it was explained to me is that if a medical research team or a doctor or whoever figures out a better way to treat a heart attack, you know, which is, of course, a critical medical event, they don't keep it a secret. They don't use it as a selling point for their hospital. It's shared throughout the entire field so that others can learn, can adapt to it, can improve on it. It's this idea that if you know a better way to do something, it's your responsibility to share it with others. And, you know, reading achievement is Well, it's not quite at heart attack levels yet, but it's certainly, you know, we could do a lot better. And so what they're saying, what they're claiming, if their data is to be trusted, and it hasn't, I don't believe it's been released yet, they're claiming that they have something like an 11% improvement rate after just about a year of implementing this. And so if they're able to bring those scores up and continue to improve, well, then that's probably something that, you know, that should be pursued.
So a couple times in your story, the question comes up. If you're spending this much more time on reading, what are you not spending time on? And is it coming out of other subjects which may not be quite as important as reading, but are still very important? What's the response to that?
The response to that is that the test scores, if you go by the test scores, nobody, no other subject area is suffering. Keep in mind that this is K through 3 right now. I mean, this is rather, it's aimed at the youngest children. I don't think they're studying organic chemistry right just yet.
Not yet, no.
And so, you know, they're doing some science, but you know, what they, like they say, reading is fundamental. I think you can work a reading lesson into a science lesson. And I think that that's just because the ability to read and understand, you know, words written on a page, it doesn't always have to be in the structure of a strict reading lesson. It can also be done in a science lesson or even math.
So as we said, this is showing signs of promise, maybe not necessarily enough to say that we're ready to go statewide or something like that. What else do people want to see? What's kind of the next step in figuring out whether or not this really is having the desired effect on reading?
Well, I think we, first of all, the data has to be independently analyzed. This program is just getting off the, you know, off the ground. EdTrust Midwest, we called them for a comment and they said, you know, they really couldn't say anything because they hadn't looked at the data yet. So that's the first thing. And, you know, see whether or not this is anomalous or if this is something that can be built upon and banked on. I mean, that would probably be the first thing. The other thing is, I think, to always continue to look for better ways of doing it. There are other states that are trying different approaches, and, you know, maybe there's a way to weave some of that stuff in there. This is really a very basic kind of approach. I mean, it's basically, it's a best practices thing. But if you can, you know, if it plateaus, maybe it needs to be adjusted. I don't know. That's a, you know, maybe that's a question for the people who are working on this program.
How important overall is data to this effort, you know, at the district level, maybe at the school building level, and right down to each individual child?
Essential. It's really essential. At Woodbridge Elementary, for instance, there is a whiteboard in a conference room. Now, this is out of sight of the children, you know, in the school, but it has every child in every grade who is reading below where they should be. And it's laid out with, you know, it's by first name, and there is at the top, it's like, you know, K1, 2, 3, and it says, okay, they should start at this level, they should be here at the middle of the year, they should be here at the end of the year. And then below that is the list of all the kids and where they are and where they need to be. And I visited, well, let's see, I guess it was in November, late November, and the you could see where some kids had already had their initial letter crossed out and a new one put in. So, you know, it's really essential. It's a matter of tracking where every single child is reading, where they need to be, asking what do they need to move on. And then when they do move on, you know, making a big deal out of it. That was one of the things that I found kind of interesting. One of the principals said, don't hide this stuff from kids. I mean, they don't have to see the whiteboard with everybody's name on it. But if a child needs to improve, let them know they need to improve. And then when they do improve, you know, make a fuss over it. I mean, that's encouraging to little kids. And so it really is absolutely essential. It's not enough to have, you know, be good on average. You have to be looking at every single child in the class.
Nancy Derringer, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me, Gordon. It was great.
Bridge staff writer Nancy Derringer joined us via Skype. A link to her story, called In State with Low Reading Scores, A West Michigan Effort Shows Promise, can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.